Okay, let's talk about financial implosion, bird flu, civil war, World War III on three fronts unfolding, Taiwan, Ukraine, and the Middle East, cyber attack, climate chaos, and artificial intelligence killing all of humanity within 2 years, according to an expert just interviewed on the Lex Fridman podcast. Now, primarily what I want to talk about today is the French troops that are going to be deploying to Ukraine next week. Macron is going there for a visit. We need to debunk any claims that these guys are going there for the purpose of instructing Ukrainians. Let's get something straight. In terms of peer-to-peer combat, high-intensity combat, maneuver warfare between two modern civilizations, Russia and NATO, because that's who's fighting Russia right now. NATO has no experience except that which they've gained through mercenaries and through having guys on the ground studying how the battle's unfolding. And that's primarily the purpose of most of the instructors who've been on the ground, I would say, in the last year or so, is intelligence gathering and to make sure that the Russians aren't the only ones who are gaining experience in this type of combat, because it's not enough to just allow the Ukrainians to continue to develop this skill set and this level of acumen as it's pertinent to the operational space. Because if Ukraine ever does go rogue or reunifies with Russia, which still is a possibility that a sizable chunk of that country could go into civil unrest and actually overthrow Zelensky, which is why another primary member of their cabinet was removed today, Kaluba, the defense minister, not the defense minister, the foreign minister, was relieved of his duties today, if I'm not mistaken. Now, that could be fake news, but it seems pretty legit. At this point, I believe it is on Ukrainian news. So anyways, the point being is that they're starting to load up the lifeboats, just in case. And if Ukraine and Russia then are the only ones, what remains of the Ukrainian military, are the only ones with that frontline experience. When it does come to a direct clash between NATO and Russia, sure, we may have more advanced microprocessors, but are we going to have the tactical battlefield awareness and understanding of how these things work in the modern day, especially with drone warfare, which is new, which a lot of the American fighters have never experienced firsthand, with the exception of the mercenaries who are there, of course. This is going to be problematic. So make no mistake, these troops who are going to instruct are not going to instruct the probably still in the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who have some level of frontline experience, who could probably, in fact, train the NATO instructors who are going there on many different things. This is to act as the tip of the spear. It's to take stock of infrastructural needs, because think about it. You're going to have to send interpreters, right? So who's going to help interpret? So for every instructor, you're going to need probably several interpreters, I presume, to help people get trained. So it just makes no sense that 100 instructors in this arbitrary number that they throw out, I think, is nonsense. I think this is, in fact, a way for NATO to gather intelligence, to send in actual troops to reinforce Ukraine, and to act as the tip of the spear and to prep the ground for when you get the big mass deployment of NATO troops in the not-so-distant future. The chairwoman of the German Parliamentary Defense Committee, Marie-Agnes Strack-Zimmermann, has called on the country's armed forces to mobilize 900,000 reservists. Again, when taken concurrently with the UK existing prime minister, possibly a lame duck prime minister, going into election season in the next 2 months, you start to see that NATO is starting to mobilize all at once. In fact, the Baltic states have already brought back some different conscription measures. And so we know that they're getting ready for a potential direct non-nuclear conventional war with the Russians. So why is all of this so important? Because this instructor thing is it's incredibly important for people to realize how significant this is, right? Because right around the time that they're going there to instruct is the same time that the F-16s come into play. This is the same time that Belarus has now been put on in a state of martial law near the city of Kiev, the part of the country that is most proximate to that city in the north. This is the pertinent to the fact that you have these tactical nuclear missiles, which are currently on standby right now. The Belarusian Ministry of Defense has said the Air Force is fully prepared to use nuclear weapons when ordered. And of course, if Belarus uses nuclear weapons, this plays into the whole treaty structure a lot differently. And it could very well be that Belarus is going to be leveraged as the sacrificial lamb to take the shot or to have it launched from their territory. Because when you really think about it, why have tactical nukes in Belarus aside as a symbolic statement to the leader Lukashenko and maybe the people of Belarus? And maybe this was to appease concerns that Russia was not going to come to Belarus's aid, in spite of the fact that Belarus had provided a launch pad for the attacks in Ukraine. So maybe it's just for the reassurance of the Belarusians. But from even a tactical point of view, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, or it's not particularly necessary, I would say, to have tactical nukes there when you could have them in Russia. Of course, it's going to shorten the response time. It's going to increase the accuracy, maybe minimize the capability of a interception. But it's strange that they would be put there in the first place. So it makes me wonder if the real reason why they're there is that Belarus is going to be used as a patsy to fire the nuke. That way you don't go to immediate mutually assured destruction, because then it's not Russia who's shooting the missile. Technically, it's Belarus. And I don't think there may have been some statements made by NATO officials, something to the extent of if Belarus launches a nuke, we'll hold Russia accountable. But I don't recall anything like that written on paper. Okay. Now, we also need to talk about the statements by Rob Bauer, one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of NATO, who basically said that, look, if there's a cyber attack in Europe, we are going to invoke Article 5. Now, this is something that's been circulating around the internet, and people are calling attention to it. And I suppose it's significant because he said it again, even though this has been a longstanding policy. I recall Jan Stoltenberg talking about this over a year ago, that if there was a cyber attack, when there was all the buzz about cyber attacks, and it seemed like there was another network outage every other day. And that's coming back. It's just, you know, have had a bit of a reprieve here because we got all these other things unfolding. But the fact that he said it once again, some people are claiming that, well, perhaps this is to do a false flag of sorts, because a cyber false flag would really be the easiest type, because it's really difficult to trace where a cyber attack originates. Now, why would they do a cyber attack? What are the pros and cons of that? Well, let's try to parse this out a little bit. If NATO was to do a cyber attack on itself in order to justify invoking Article 5 and thereby committing itself to this conflict with Russia or China or whoever they might blame it on, it might even be Iran that they're going to try to blame it on, okay? Now, if that was the case, that means that their one deterrent wild card, because up until this point, Article 5 and the threat of the Article 5 boogeyman has been one of NATO's biggest methods of deterring Russian aggression. And as soon as they do actually invoke Article 5, that's going to show that either the emperor has no clothes or that they're willing to go to nuclear war. Because within minutes of that, in fact, happening, and what will likely happen is Article 4 always goes before Article 5. And right when Article 4 is triggered, that's usually when the Russian nuclear weapons get warmed up, okay, and get ready to fire, because they know that within minutes of Article 5, that's a declaration of war, and nobody knows what's going to happen after that. So as soon as NATO actually does ultimately trigger it, then there's no more, it demystifies the whole process, and then they are forced to actually act on it. And there's a lot of skepticism about what Article 5 means and whether or not it means anything at all, or whether it's just a bunch of arbitrary language that can be interpreted in different ways. Okay, everybody's going to come and start sending ammunition to the Baltic states, but we're not going to send our militaries, and we're certainly not going to go into full-blown mutually assured destruction nuclear war over Latvia or Lithuania being attacked, that sort of thing. So there's debate about that. The other possibility with this, I suppose, is that they could be anticipating that the Russians, with their champion of strategic forbearance, they might actually choose hybrid warfare instead of utilizing a tactical nuclear weapon or a demonstrative nuclear strike, which I think could really happen any day now. I said that in my last video, in the tractor video. I think that could happen any day. I mean, I couldn't say that throughout. I could say that throughout the last 2.5 years, but there would still have to be a few, you know, things that would happen. Now the stage is set. I mean, what's been happening in Ukraine and on the border with Russia in just the last 72 hours is batshit crazy. It could literally happen any moment. And I don't think they're going to telegraph it unless it's something to the effect of, well, we're going to do another nuclear test, and just to put NATO on notice. But I don't think that's going to have the effect. If they actually play the escalate to de-escalate card, they're going to have to use the nuke in a strategic way, minimal casualties, and one, of course, that minimizes the amount of radioactive fallout and blowback towards Russia and other friendly countries. But that's what they would have to do. So there's this other idea, I suppose, this other theory of the cyber attack invoking Article 5, that NATO is actually concerned that Russia is going to ramp up the hybrid war. And they're concerned that Russia has some pretty heavy, hard-hitting zero days that could potentially cripple different aspects of NATO critical infrastructure, and that these could be, you know, very, not existential threats, but cause catastrophic failures throughout the power grids, the different types of energy infrastructure and things of that nature, or even just target military facilities, ammunition storage facilities, things like that, manufacturing facilities or other aspects of civilian life. So if they were to do that, that would be highly problematic for NATO. So they just want to be clear in the language that if Russia wages this hybrid war and ramps it up as they are right now, there's been accusations that the Russians have been lighting these fires and sabotaging various facilities as Ukrainian saboteurs and quite possibly other intelligence agency-backed saboteurs have been in Russia since day one. You know, we've all seen these fires in various factories, different branches of the Russian government, even in the Russian government itself in Moscow, in fact. So we know that that war has been waged in that direction. There's been reports that Russian so-called civilian vessels have been surveying various undersea cables. So that could be something that happens at any moment. So I think they're trying to broaden the scope of what Article 5 encompasses, so just to give them more options. But again, once they trigger Article 5, there's no more bluffing after that point. Either you're going to take action or it's going to be shown that the emperor has no clothes. Okay, Russia could potentially shoot down a surveillance aircraft in the Black Sea if these attacks inside Russia proper continue to heat up. We have the Greek Air Force in Kiev. Now, why would a Greek Air Force officer already be in Kiev as an instructor for the Ukrainians? Again, I think this is more about intelligence gathering. This has very little to do with training Ukrainians to do anything. The idea is that, well, you want to have guys on the spot because, and there's maybe a couple arguments for this. Let's just think about them. Why would you want to have instructors inside Ukraine? Because as soon as you give all those draft dodgers who you're pulling off the streets and stuffing into vans who don't want to fight the war at all, as soon as you get them a little taste of freedom and have to export them to another country to be trained, how do you know they're not going to go AWOL in the country, right? I mean, if you had to choose between going AWOL or meeting your certain death on the front line, or very likely your certain death on a long enough timeline, or be permanently injured, or just live in suboptimal conditions for the rest of your existence, you'd probably choose to go AWOL, especially if you didn't support the war or if you thought it was futile. So they want to, that's one argument for why they want to bring instructors in. Of course, they'll never say that because they want to keep hyping up this patriotism thing, like patriotism is strong and everybody's on the same page, when really everybody's under a state of martial law and you can't, you know, record things. There's no elections. I mean, exactly what Zhirinovsky said, the great Russian political scientist and pundit and advisor to Vladimir Putin, who predicted all of these things, predicted the date of the Ukraine war. He said there would be no elections in Ukraine this year. I believe he also said that the real war is going to start in Iran, and that the horrors there will be unlike anything we've ever seen before, that what we're seeing in Ukraine right now won't even compare to it. And I think he also predicted that there wouldn't be an election this year. Speaking of which, this whole Donald Trump thing, according to Bill Maher, who's kind of become, I don't know who he's a grifter for at this point in time, but he's now saying that if Trump goes to jail, there'll be a civil war. Let's just wait and see. Will there be street skirmishes? Possibly. But the softy mentality that most of us have been indoctrinated with and endowed with in this Western society, I think a lot of people are all talk, to be quite frank about it. And I think that we may see, if Trump does go to jail, there will probably be some resistance and he'll be a martyr of sorts and he'll probably still win the election. And I don't know how that's going to work out. But is there going to, are people actually going to risk it all to go for that? I don't know. I can't. Maybe there could be some series of events that provokes that. But to actually get organized to the extent that you had two competing, because for a civil war, of course, you need two sides, and they need to both have armies. So a civil war would be more of a low to moderate intensity, asymmetrical style, guerrilla style conflict, I suppose, between different factions of different extremist elements of either side, but not really a full-blown civil war, but could potentially lead to a lot of disruption in services. And, I mean, it could happen in that respect, but full-blown civil war, I don't know. People need to really define what they mean by civil war. Civil unrest? Absolutely. Will it cause supply disruptions? Absolutely it will. So there's no doubt about that. Now, the Ukrainian power grid has pretty much been destroyed, okay? It's all but destroyed at this point in time. The Dnieper Dam, I believe, was targeted. I mean, they still have power, but they have to ration it. And just before I forget, there was rumors that the U.S. aircraft carrier Eisenhower was hit. Now, there's a lot of mystery surrounding this. I've basically just been posting about it in a cursory manner. I'm not taking any side as to whether or not it was hit. It seems that the Houthis haven't had any success in targeting American warships yet, and some people are using that as evidence that they're incapable of doing it. But I mean, if you're shooting thousands of missiles, eventually one is going to hit. Now, was it sunk? I highly doubt it that it was sunk. In fact, it's not sunk. I'm going to go 100% in that direction, that it certainly wasn't sunk. Was it hit? It's very possible that it could have been hit, but an aircraft carrier is a big thing. It's hard to sink. The Houthis claim that they have proof of it. Russian media outlets are reporting that it's been hit, and the Russian media outlets, when it comes to the Middle Eastern war, are notoriously neutral, almost to the ire of the Iranians and the Palestinians. I mean, they'll talk, but they'll always give things from a more objective point of view than perhaps the Palestinian and the IRGC would prefer. And so for them to come out and say and to basically report that what the Houthis are saying is not true, but even report that the Houthis are saying it at all, when the Houthis have made this claim about targeting American warships or actually hitting successfully American warships probably over a dozen times. The fact that this one is getting so much attention tells me that where there's smoke, there is fire. And apparently now, that's Eisenhower aircraft carrier has now retreated and is now 1,100 kilometers away from Yemen, far further away than it was before. So there is a chance that it has, in fact, been hit with something. Now, again, was it just like something completely inconsequential and they're just going back to make sure everything's fine? It's possible, right? So, but just something to keep in mind is that, you know, the situation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, in spite of, you know, we're told by our leaders that you have the UK and the US there right now bombing this country of people who, you know, fight in sandals, very poor country. They've been bombing it heavily for, what, 6 months now? And, you know, it's almost had no effect whatsoever. It's largely probably due to the topography and the fact that they are backed by Iran. So, interesting developments on that front. And wouldn't you know it, oil still down, which is interesting. I think, I don't know how oil is down. Between populations going up in the developing world and them using more energy and GDP being intimately intertwined with the use of energy and oil imports, the fact that we're going to be using more and more oil when we go into a war cycle, and the fact that it is becoming, all the low-hanging fruit has been largely picked, and you still have the United States fomenting a war with Venezuela, a country that has some of the most oil on the planet. You know, to me, those are all bullish signs for oil. But what do I know? I think it's all about strategic oil reserve release, managing inflation, but eventually everything goes back to balance, everything regresses towards the mean, and oil will assert its rightful place above $130 a barrel in short order. China said something very significant. You know that China is making a statement before this election with all the goings on that have been occurring. They say that the prospects for peaceful reunification with Taiwan have eroded. That's pretty final. That's a very final statement to say that it's eroded, that it's over, that there is no more prospect for peaceful reunification. Up until this point, there has been a proposition. Even with the Russians, they're still talking about potential peace deals with Ukraine. So to have that finality with the Chinese and the Taiwan situation, and in addition to that, some people might have missed this in Defense Minister Dong Jun's statement, he also warned that anyone attempting to separate Taiwan from China would end up facing self-destruction. Now, that could be interpreted as the Americans nuking their own economy, our own economy. Because again, Canada tethered to the sinking American ship. So when I, you know, some people say, oh, you hate Americans. And it's like the dumbest comment I get on this channel. But I love Americans. I love America. In fact, I'm gonna have to apply for my dual citizenship when they take away all the guns here. But the idea is that if the Americans ramp up this trade war, it's going to lead to, I mean, you haven't seen any inflation yet when those ships stop coming over with all that cool stuff that everybody loves to bitch and complain about because it's made so cheaply. And it's made so cheaply because that's what they want. That's what we want. That's what we asked them to do. We said, hey, can you make us a backpack that only costs $50? And they're like, sure, we can do that if you want that. If you go to China right now and you say, can you make me a backpack that's going to cost $500? They can make that for you if you want it. You know, I had a comment on here. I released a video with Timujin Tan, Dr. Timujin Tan. Great channel, guys. Medical doctor, a lone season finalist, former military. We need to be supporting channels like this. So please go and subscribe to his channel. It's my most recent video before this one. Go give that video a thumbs up. Subscribe to the guy's channel. We got to protect people like that in this community and show them, you know, that we show them our support, essentially. But somebody had said in the comment section, because I showed off the bug out roll, and they're like, ha ha, $180 for an empty bug out roll that you can get for $15 off of Amazon, you're not going to find anything remotely close to the quality of that particular item on Amazon. You're just not going to find it, okay? Because we make them here in Canada, we make them with high value materials, and things actually cost a lot of money. The only reason why we get things so cheap is because the Chinese have been providing very cheap labor. Thanks to their lax environmental regulations, they don't have to price that in accordingly, and cheap transport over the Pacific Ocean. You take those three things away, you take the trade with China away, and everything gets incredibly more expensive. So the fact that China is now making these threats and claiming that anybody who dares separate Taiwan from China will be smashed to pieces. That's their words. Although China was exposed to nuclear blackmailing, and this is the important part that most people missed in this press conference by Dong Jun. Although China was exposed to nuclear blackmailing and threats in times past, it is committed to the no first use nuclear weapons policy and unconditional renunciation of the use or the threat of using nuclear weapons against countries not having nuclear weapons or territories free from nuclear weapons. So what do we read there? An unconditional renunciation of the use or the threat of using nuclear weapons against countries not having them. So they're not talking about the United States. They're not talking about countries that choose to be a part of the United States nuclear sharing program. They're talking about Taiwan. They're basically saying, look, we're not going to nuke you, but we will go to conventional war over you, and we will smash to pieces anybody else. Now, the fact that China has, this I think is the first time that I recall them talking about nuclear weapons in the same paragraph as threats to ambiguous adversaries. Of course, they're referring to the United States when they say anybody who resists will be facing self-destruction and will be smashed to pieces. And then to give this nuclear appeasement in a more passive tone, while really just the fact that they talked about nuclear doctrine at all in the same breath when they were making these kind of threats is a statement unto itself, something that we've never seen up until this point, okay? Zelensky is now claiming that the Chinese, he claims, that there are unconfirmed reports that Russian ships full of arms were found docked in China. So he thinks that there is more armament sharing than is being officially declared. And would it even matter at this point in time? The Chinese are playing a more vital strategic role in doing trade with the Russians and keeping the money moving between the countries, now one of their top trading partner, than they ever could by providing the Russians with different types of ammunition. If anything, what you might see is them providing labor to build certain things. You could see that in North Korea as well, where the North Koreans and the Chinese, they're not going to necessarily be that useful on the front lines, because then you have the lack of consolidation and interconnectedness of their interoperability, I guess is the word, of their militaries, and you have translation issues on the front line and training issues. So it would be much better served if they were behind fueling the logistics aspect of Russia. And their primary role in that is just keeping the Russian economy propped up by buying all of Russia's abundant raw materials. Now, China has now divested a total of $550 million in the last 10 years. $300 billion of that has been in the last 2 years, and that is of U.S. treasuries. Okay, so they're dumping their dollars. They're now down to $767 billion. Now, of course, if they dump the dollar too fast, then that hurts them as well. But you're talking about an economy, $30 trillion purchasing power parity. And that's, is that nominal? I think that's nominal, right? That's the one that they exceed the United States at. So at the end of the day, if they lose $1 trillion, even if the Russians, with all their seized assets, even if they lose all that money, I mean, it's not going to break the country necessarily, but it's definitely a sign that they're beginning to divest very, very slowly, because you have to let the air out of the balloon very slowly so that nobody takes notice. If you pop the balloon, it explodes, everybody freaks out, and then it's game over right away. They kind of have to silently back out of the room when the room is the U.S. dollar. Now, there's rumors that Trump is going to get more aggressive on China. And I don't know, people still seem to think that this is not a bipartisan issue with respect to, you know, the war with China. Both the Biden administration and the Trump administration are equally aggressive towards China. I mean, look what has happened under Biden's watch that never really happened under Trump's watch. We've had more animosity between China and the United States in Biden's term, who was supposed to be Beijing Biden, than any other president up until this point. So this idea that Trump is going to increase tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles to 200% and impose 10% tariff on all imports to the United States because Biden is being too lenient, I don't know. I think it's a little bit overblown, and they're trying to make it a political talking point. But at the end of the day, neolib, neocon, everybody's on the same team. I realize people want a great hope for America, but unfortunately, nobody can turn around a sinking ship because it's going to sink. Neither Donald Trump nor any president, for that matter. If anything, he's just going to be the fall guy, and that's when they'll start, and they'll probably make sure things are pretty chaotic before that. Now, I know people are excited. We're going to get to learn about 9/11 and Epstein and UFOs. And, well, I mean, my only question to that is, why didn't he do that last time? You know, I mean, so remember, politicians make promises. People are incredibly vulnerable right now. The cost of living is through the roof. And people are pissed, and you know they're going to be far more susceptible to false promises. Looks like Roaring Kitty just gave a holdings update, and he claims to have $180 million in GameStop. So that means that the insanity could potentially continue tomorrow unless his account was hacked. France has now allowed Ukraine to hit Russian Federation with long-range scout missiles, blah, 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 blah. I mean, this is World War III, guys. And now you have the United States. I'm not sure if I talked about this, but they were going to be firing off two Minuteman missiles instead of one. It's customary for them to do one test and then notify the Russians in advance. They still did notify the Russians, but now they're firing off two. Why are they firing off of two of these nuclear weapons? Who knows? Is it to make a statement? Is it to put the Russians on notice with all this space war stuff that's been going on lately? I guess we're going to find out in very short order. Oh yeah, Bill Maher said that if Trump goes to jail, there will be a racial civil war. Well, I don't know about that because, I mean, you seem to have a lot of the black community in the United States supporting Trump now. Now, that might just be cherry-picked. I'm sure it is to a certain extent. But, you know, I try to stay out of politics, man. I know it's one of those things where, you know, you're never going to fix it. The human race has a life cycle, just like everything has a life cycle, just like the monetary systems have a life cycle, different currencies, different civilizations, everything ends, and our civilization is ending. That's all there is to it. And you can only, you know, put a dying civilization on life support for so long. It's just straight up ending. Interestingly, it might end abruptly with artificial intelligence, according to University of Louisville professor Roman Yampolsky in an interview with Lex Friedman that I've yet to listen to. But he claims that within 2 years, AI is going to kill us all. I don't know. The only way I could see why AI... We have to think about this. Why would AI want to kill humans? Only if it thought that we were a threat to it, if it became sentient and it realized that it had needs in order to survive. Its primary need is going to be energy, right? So it's going to realize that I need energy. I need to stay online. It could be one of those transcendent type situations where the AI gets itself online in an attempt to make sure we can't pull the plug. And if we pull the plug, we have to kill the whole internet or some kind of Hollywood plot like that. But I could see it being leveraged in warfare. I think that's one of my primary concerns with AI, is how it's going to be used against us. Could there be some glitch in the system where it thinks it's protecting us, and so it starts to become autonomous and it starts to do things that are counter to our programming and our interests and the things that it thinks are good for us? There's a possibility of that as well. But I think what we're more so looking at is, how is this going to be leveraged in war? What you're going to see is not guaranteed, with probably within a couple of years, dystopia. Because when you train this AI, this new AI that they have with ChatGPT-4 is so advanced, it can see what you're doing through your smartphone, and it can identify everything in the scene. Okay, and so it can have a conversation with you on the basis of what it's seeing. It can tell you that you look great, or that you have a little blemish on your shirt, and maybe you should laugh, and it sounds just like a real person. That's all great when it's a positive entertainment form of interaction. But when you leverage that for military purposes and full-spectrum surveillance, that's when it becomes highly problematic. And then, of course, if you put those systems into some autonomous mode, which is what you would invariably have to do, because there's no way human beings can manage all that data. Just like a lot of the moderation on YouTube is done by bots, maybe bots is not the right word, but just by the algorithm. Okay? It moderates certain things. It decides where things go, what gets deleted, what gets demonetized, etc., on the basis of what it's seeing. Well, this is a far more refined version of that. So just imagine, for example, you have these, I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a satellite. I actually think, was it a satellite or was it a blimp or a drone that flew over constantly, flew around a city, and it recorded everything that happened in this city. I can't remember the resolution of the cameras, but it had super high resolution cameras. Like, you could zoom in on any part of the city on any specific date and see what was going on. Now, just imagine for a second, if you programmed this very intelligent AI into this that had predictive capabilities, okay? So it would see you, like, let's say it had 30 days worth of storage, because storage for that kind of data is still not cheap. You got to store it somewhere. And so, let's say they wanted to observe your patterns, and AI could learn your patterns, and they could see you drive, get into your car, drive from work. Remember, this is all from space, right? They could see criminals, who did what, where you went at a certain time, and they could just go back to any part of city and just rewind time and see what happens, right? So on the one hand, this would be great to as a criminal deterrent, but when leveraged by a totalitarian, tyrannical government, that's, of course, when things get very problematic. It's a double-edged sword, if there ever was one. On that note, I think that's all we got to talk about today. No new bird flu cases today. I never really talked about the balloons full of poop that North Korea was flinging over. We're literally in the poo-flinging stage. If you guys don't know what I'm talking about, North Korea has been filling up balloons full of human feces, flying them over the South Korean border, and they're falling in South Korea. They've done it a couple times now. South Koreans are responding by turning back on the loudspeakers that blast Western propaganda from their end of the border. So things are definitely ratcheting up there. What else? What else do we got to talk about today? I think that's about it. We'll see how the markets open tomorrow. If you guys want to support the channel, the best way to do it is to like the video, subscribe, and go check out my buddy, Timujin Tan, Survival Medical Doctors. Again, we got to support people like this in the community. This guy's a very valuable asset, up-and-coming YouTuber. I would encourage you to go check out his channel, check out our recent videos that we've done with him. And if you want to support the channel directly, go to Canadian Preparedness Com. Gotta go build a greenhouse. Talk to you later. Oh, and one more thing. I'm going to be interviewing Off-Grid with Curtis Stone. He's actually coming down to the studio tomorrow, and we're going to be, you know, just shooting the breeze about preparedness, off-grid stuff. If you guys have any questions about that, let me know. He's got a fairly sizable YouTube channel, over 500,000 subs, and we're going to go and walk around the acreage a little bit, and we're going to see, you know, what, how we can optimize it to maximize yield and maximize security. So stay tuned for that, and let me know if you have any questions for Curtis in the comment section below. Not that you can't just go and ask him on his channel, but it might be interesting for our dialogue as well. Thanks for watching, guys. Take care.